I'm your host, Maddie.
And I'm Natalie.
And we are jumping into episode 15.
I know.
15, right? Yeah. And yes, it's the third week of December. And it's funny because I have in my notes, I was going to comment on the fact that there is no snow still in Minnesota, which is pretty weird for us.
Yeah.
But of course, we actually got a little snowfall today.
A nice light dusting.
Yeah.
It's a good amount.
It's like still the beginning of the year, so it still is pretty looking, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so, and I also want to mention, we mentioned this last week, but today will be our last full episode before a very brief little holiday break.
Yes.
Yeah. It's only a, what, two-episode break?
Two-episode break, so we'll be back on the 4th.
Yeah.
We just need some, you know, time to celebrate the holidays and, you know, get our mental health back up to speed.
And you have finals, right?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I'm almost done. I've done all my final projects except for one.
Woo.
That's due on Tuesday, so I gotta, like, hurry up and do that. But then after that, we're just taking a break, and we're gonna just, I don't know, it's gonna be good.
Just enjoy the holidays, yeah. I don't know, I was up to some holiday festivities this week. Do you want to go first for your highs and lows, or...
Oh, you can go first.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, so I was going to say, my high this week, I haven't really been feeling in the Christmas spirit yet this year. Because, I mean, one, we're, like, locked inside. There's, like, no Santas in the mall. There's no going to the mall. Like, it's just been a, you know, bummer Christmas. But also, there hasn't been snow on the ground. So, I just haven't felt very Christmassy.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to a Christmas light show last night.
Oh, was that at the fairgrounds or?
It was actually in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So...
I know they're doing one at the fairgrounds this
year. Oh, really?
Yeah.
That'd be really cool because the fairgrounds are gigantic.
Yeah.
But it was really fun. It got me in the Christmas mood for sure. And, oh God.
Sorry, your couch was just preparing to jump on the counter for like 30 seconds. Like, she was just, like, hopping up and down, like, trying to jump.
And she's not supposed to be on the counter. I just, like, looked up and I saw you looking with your eyes, like, super wide behind me. I'm like, what are my cats doing? Like, I just immediately know they're up to some shenanigans.
Yeah, but the light show, how was
it? Yeah, so it was in Wisconsin. I have family in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
It's, so my brother's wife and my adorable little niece met us there. And
fun.
It was cool. It was interesting, though. So, like, before I went, you know, I've been locked inside like everybody else. And so I found myself, like, pre-gaming a Christmas light show, like, just getting pumped because, you know, I hadn't been out of the house in weeks.
Nice.
So, it was pretty fun. It's really different in Wisconsin, I'll say that for sure, with, like, restrictions. So,
oh,
it was
really?
Kind of weird.
Like, they don't have as much or what?
Yeah, it's super lax, which is, like, kind of weird to see. We, like, kept our distance from people, but, like, people were kind of all huddled together and not wearing masks, and it was kind of crazy over there, so...
That's weird. It's weird to see.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, a big contrast from over here in Minnesota right now. But yeah, that was my high this week. I would say my low... So this really sucks. If you've been listening to past episodes, you've known that, like, Jack's car blew up pretty much.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm not even exaggerating.
Yeah. Engine's like was like smoking, right?
Yeah. There's like a hole in his engine. So he's had his car at the shop and we were waiting on the warranty and that took weeks and then we were waiting for it to be fixed. And on Saturday we finally got the call that we could pick it up. So on the way back from the Christmas light show, it was like 11 o'clock at night. And my mom, who went with us, dropped us off at the shop to pick up his car.
Oh, no.
And, like, we get in it, it starts up great, we're super excited and happy. And we live, like, a mile away from this shop.
Okay.
And on the way home, it starts smelling like burning oil really, really bad. And we're the only car on the road.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And we're just like, oh, my gosh. That's not good. And then we park and like his engine was literally smoking, like there's smoke billowing out of his engine. So yeah, and we literally have spent thousands on fixing this, so I'm
oh
just
my
like
gosh.
Praying that it's fine. Maybe they just like forgot to do one little step. Like,
are you gonna take it back though?
Like, yeah. Oh, okay. Because he's like scared to even drive it a little bit.
Oh yeah. So, no, I would not recommend driving a car that's smoking from the engine.
Like, yeah. So that was kind of a bummer, I'd say.
Yeah.
But yeah, what were your highs and lows this week?
My highs and lows. Well, I don't really have a low, and I'm not gonna like squeeze one out. Yeah.
Don't force a low.
Yeah. So I'm just gonna like enjoy the fact that I don't have a low this week. But my high was that we did a concert live stream, which we haven't done yet.
Oh, cool.
So that was really cool. We saw the Aquabats, which is one of my favorite bands.
I saw that was on your Spotify Wrapped as like your top artist, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. For the past 2 years, they've been my top artist.
Oh my gosh.
In fact, my top songs of 2019 playlist back last year was like literally just all Aquabats songs. Like, I'm not even joking. That's all I listened to in 2019. So, and yeah, there's quite a few on my 2021. But yeah, we got to see, they did kind of like a little Christmas like comedy type show with also like a concert.
Cool.
It was really cool. I enjoyed that. So that was my high for the week.
So you're doing like holiday festivities too this week.
Yeah, yeah. It was like a little Christmas thing, and they had like Santa suits on, and it was cute.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So, I love the holidays.
Yeah, it was kind of fun to like quote unquote go to a concert. Like,
right. The modern day concert, I guess. Gosh, I can't wait for a real concert again. Like,
I kind of liked it actually more, and I feel
really?
Like, oh, I don't know. I just have like such crowd anxiety, you know, like in big crowds. Plus, you know, I'm short. Like, you're short too, but we're both really short.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like I'm always behind a tall person that's like really drunk or something. That's just annoying.
You know, considering like how socially anxious I am, I surprisingly am totally fine at like concert crowded environments.
Oh.
One time, me and Jack were at the ASAP Rocky concert.
Uh huh.
And we were packed in like sardines, which is hard to imagine now.
Oh god,
you know?
I know.
Like, everybody's sweaty bodies, like,
I
shoulder
hate that.
To shoulder.
Oh, I can't stand it.
Right. But I was just like so excited to see ASAP Rocky that I didn't care. We like got to the front too, which like that was a war. It was a battlefield. Like, I just remember Jack grabbed my hand and he's like, "Let's go," and like we dove into this crowd.
Gosh,
and at one point,
so hard to imagine now.
I know, right? It's just as nuts. The good days, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, I literally felt my feet rise off of the floor and like not touch the floor again for a few seconds because there were so many people packed in around
me. Oh my god!
I was,
like
pushed suspended
you
in air. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah,
that's crazy. I don't like that. That just like freaks me out. I get really anxious in like big crowds like that where it's like, I just want to be able to, like, move my arms, like, all the way around my body.
Yeah.
That's how much space I need. I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I've, like, gotten like that during shows before where I'm just like, I need to get out now for a moment.
Yeah, you have? Because I've got that, too, before where I was like, ugh, I don't know, just, you just get, like,
you have to take, like, breaks,
mm-hmm.
you know, pace yourself.
Yes.
Ugh, can't wait for those to happen again, but.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, actually, one time we saw in 2019 we did actually see the Aquabats live in concert, so that was cool. But it was a really hot summer day. I think it was in like July.
Mm-hmm.
And it just started raining, and we parked like so far from the venue that we were sopping wet by the time we got in there, and everyone was sopping wet, and it was super hot, so it was just like hot and steamy,
like,
and wet. But it was still the best concert of my life.
Yeah. You know, one time, that's the thing, like, with outdoor concerts, because Minnesota gets super cold, but in the summer, it can get, like, 100 degrees.
Oh, yeah. This was actually an indoor event.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I went to an outdoor concert. It was actually Soundset, like, years ago, and I was seeing Tyler, the Creator, set, and he's, like,
nice.
One of my favorite artists, so I was, like, super pumped.
That's
but
awesome.
This was, like, later in the day, and we were packed in there because I wanted to get up close, and the sun, it was like a 100-degree day, and the sun was beating down on my head, and there was no shade, and I hadn't been drinking water all day.
Oh no!
Like,
did you get like a heat?
Like, yeah, like I felt like my vision was going dim. Like, I seriously felt like I was about to pass out and faint. And so like, it took so long for me to finally say like, Jack, like, we need to get out of here now. I need like a break. because he's my favorite artist, so I was fighting it, but eventually I'm like, I need, like,
that's how you know, like, it's bad.
Yeah, I know, like, I really tried, but I seriously felt like I was gonna faint and be trampled on.
Oh, gosh.
So,
yeah. I had seen Weezer at the State Fair. And I got really sick during that concert, too, and I was just like, I don't want to go, like, throw up in the bathroom or something, but, like, you know, because it's like, I just want to see Weezer, you know, I don't want to, like, I don't know.
Oh, what I'd give to throw up at a Weezer concert, like, nowadays.
I totally agree. Maybe Weezer will do a live stream concert.
And then we can recreate
We can throw up while
we can
watch
even
it.
Pretend to be, like, the drunk nice girls in the bathroom that you meet at concerts are like, oh my god, hey, add me on Snapchat.
I love your makeup.
Girl, you are awesome.
Can I borrow your mascara?
Yeah. Oh, God. I miss that just as much as concerts. That was, like, a part of the experience.
Yeah, I definitely, like, had a few drinks while we watched the Aquabats concert. Because I was, like, pretending, like, we were in a concert. I don't know. It's kind of silly, but that was my high for the week, so...
Well, that's good. Mm-hmm. So, what do we got for the artist death of the day? It's what day is it?
Thank
is
you
it
for
13th?
Remembering that. It is 13th today. Tomorrow will be the 14th. So, okay, Monday the 14th. Before we just get into that, though, I just want to say, like, a quick happy Hanukkah to people who celebrate that. Because if you didn't know, Hanukkah began on Thursday the 10th and it goes until the 18th. So, that's going on right now.
Good.
So,
yeah, good idea.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. I think of the Hanukkah song from Adam Sandler, of course.
Oh, yeah. Love him. Sorry. Anyway, do you want to guess what kind of artists I have for you today and where they're from?
Like, oh my gosh, that's so broad.
Is it?
Is there anything you can help to, like, narrow it down?
It's something that comes up a lot.
Does it come up a lot on, like, our show?
Yeah.
Okay, is it a painter?
Yeah.
Is it a Renaissance painter?
It's a Dutch painter.
Oh, a Dutch painter. Is it Van Gogh?
No. No, I don't know.
Of course, like, Dutch painter, ding, ding, Van Gogh.
Yeah.
Must be Van Gogh.
No, I feel like every week it's like, I have a Dutch painter for you today.
Yeah.
But today's Dutch painter is a woman.
Okay.
Yay. Her name is Lizzie Ansing, and she died on this day in 1959. And she belonged to a group of female post-impressionist painters that were influenced by the Amsterdam Impressionism movement called the Amsterdam's Joffers. Or maybe it's Joffers. I don't know. It's J-O-F-F-E-R-S.
Hmm.
Joffers?
I have no idea.
But they were a group of women artists in Amsterdam who met every week in the last quarter of the 19th century to paint and show their works together.
Cool.
And so they were known for the style that followed the example of the Amsterdam Impressionists, like I just said. And so there are just some awesome ladies that got together weekly to talk about art.
Oh my gosh, that is so interesting, because my art topic goes into, like, a group of ladies that got together weekly to have meetings and make art. So,
oh my gosh,
they kind of relate.
It's like us.
I know, right?
We get together weekly and talk about art. I love it.
Just some artsy gal pals.
Mm-hmm. So
very
that's
wholesome.
That's Lizzie Ansing.
R.I.P. Lizzie Ansing. Mm-hmm. All right. So what do you have for us for the dark topic today?
So, okay. Since today is our last episode before Christmas, I decided to cover the Covina Massacre, also known as the Santa Gunman Massacre.
Oh, boy.
Which was a mass killing that took place in Covina, California on Christmas Eve in 2008.
Okay.
So this is about a man named Bruce Jeffrey Pardo, and he had no history of violence whatsoever and no criminal record at all. And he had been married to a woman named Sylvia Ortega Pardo for about a year, and she had just settled for divorce, like, the week before Christmas. So he was required to pay her $10,000 as part of the divorce settlement, according to court documents, and Sylvia kept the wedding ring and the family dog.
Okay.
And it was speculated that they had some problems because he had concealed the fact that he had a child from a previous relationship.
Yeah, that would spark some intense feelings.
Yeah, no kidding. And it sounded like he was just, like, a really weird husband in general. Like, he refused to open up a joint bank account with her, and he wouldn't help her pay for anything, and he wouldn't, like, help her take care of her kids or anything like that. So it was just kind of like,
More of like a roommate.
I know. Kind of. Yeah, that's just like, I don't know, when you're married, like, your money isn't like your money anymore. It's like our money, you know?
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, me and Jack, because we're getting married soon, we've already had that conversation.
Yeah.
Like, and that seems like a no-brainer, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, even if you don't have a joint bank account, like, we don't have a joint bank account.
Yeah,
but
I guess,
like,
there's some couples that don't,
it's,
you know?
It's not like we're refusing to do that, or, and it's not like it's like my, it's not like I feel like the money in my bank account is my money only.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like Joe feels like the money in his bank account is his money only. It's just kind of like a whoever pays for it, pays for it kind of thing. Because it's both
like
our money. I
don't know.
Different
couples do different things. But I don't know. I'd be like a little weary if he was being secretive about his finances.
Oh, yeah. This guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so like, I don't know. Even though he didn't have like a history of violence or criminal records and whatnot, it just doesn't sound like he was an amazing person or anything, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I'll set the scene for you. Okay. So Alicia Ortega and Joe Ortega, which was Sylvia's parents.
Okay.
They were celebrating Christmas at their home on Christmas Eve in 2008. And there were about 25 people at the Christmas party, which is hard to imagine right now, but...
Mm-hmm.
So Joe and Alicia, they'd been married for 53 years. And they and their kids were playing poker in the dining room. And some of the grandchildren were playing video games. And some of them were out back by the pool. This is California, I remember. So at about 11:30 p.m., people were kind of starting to leave, but they're like kind of finishing their games and everything. And then they hear a knock at the door, and a man enters wearing a Santa suit.
Oh my God!
And of course, it was Sylvia's ex-husband, Bruce. So Bruce was holding a gift-wrapped package, so like a Christmas present.
Okay.
And it had inside a homemade flamethrower, and he was holding that in one hand, and in the other hand, he was holding a semi-automatic handgun.
What?
And he also had three additional semi-automatic handguns.
Oh my God. Just like strapped on his body?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, one of the grandchildren, she was an 8-year-old girl. She ran over to greet him saying, "Santa Claus, Santa Claus." Because she thought it was the real Santa.
Oh.
And then he fired the handgun at her face.
Oh my God.
But she turned at the last moment, so she survived but had suffered some severe injuries in her jaw. But they weren't life-threatening.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that's the first thing he does. He walks in and shoots an 8-year-old girl.
Whoa. So
it's weird to think this girl's like 20 now. She's younger than us.
I know. I wonder how she feels about Christmas every year, because you know she probably has like...
Yeah.
How old was she when this happened?
She was 8, so that's like totally coherent.
Yeah, I mean, she probably has like PTSD whenever she sees a Santa Claus. I mean, that's pretty traumatic.
Yeah, definitely.
Ugh.
So after that, he starts, like, randomly shooting at everyone. And it also is said that he pointedly stood over some members of the family to specifically shoot them, like Sylvia.
Oh, to make it more personal.
Yeah. So he was kind of, like, randomly shooting family members, and then, like, some people, he was just, like, standing over them, like, shooting at them.
Damn.
So after the shootings, he actually unwrapped the flamethrower gift and set the house on fire.
It's so weird to me that he wrapped it up.
Like, I know.
What? Why?
And dressed up, like, he took the time to, like, dress up like Santa and go over there and wrap up a flamethrower.
That's like, I mean, murdering your family alone is sick, but that makes it a whole another level of sick.
I agree. It reminds me of, like, John Wayne Gacy, like, dressing up as a clown when he murdered people. I don't know. It's just, like, he did that specifically to do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he wrapped up the flamethrower like a present. I don't know. Yeah.
Ugh.
So 9 people in total died at the house, either from gunshot wounds or from the fire. Ed Winter of the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office said, "The bodies were too badly burned to immediately determine whether they died in the shootings or the fire. We have multiple bodies inside. They are extremely charred and burned."
I feel like you shouldn't be able to acquire a flamethrower.
He made it himself somehow. Yeah.
Oh, dang.
I don't know how, but it said it was a handmade flamethrower. Homemade flamethrower.
It must have been, like, pretty substantial. I mean, it burned people to, like, a char.
Yeah, so. The fire, like, totally engulfed the house, and it spread out, like, about 40 or 50 feet out. And it took 80 firefighters an hour and a half to put out the fire.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Ugh. 3 people were injured besides the 9 who died. the 8-year-old girl who was shot in the face, of course. And then there was a 16-year-old girl who got shot and injured in the back. And a 20-year-old girl who climbed out a second-story window to avoid getting shot, and she broke her leg.
Oh my god.
Smart, though. I'd rather break my leg than get shot.
No kidding.
So one of the survivors escaped to the neighbor's house to call the police and firefighters. And after the attack, Bruce changed out of the Santa suit. I don't know if he did this, like, in his car or something. Mm-hmm. But he drove to his brother's house in Silmer, which is about 30 miles away from the crime scene, where he then killed himself by a gunshot wound to the head.
Jeez.
Yeah. So he did not get justice, I feel like. I don't know. I hate when they do that. It's like, why take everyone else down with you? Like, it's so sad.
Like, suicide's horrible, and, like, you know, obviously it's horrible whenever people do that. But, like, if that's your plan, like, why take people with you? It just
It
doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, how could it make sense, though? They're obviously, you know, ill.
Definitely. Head, it's just so weird that, like, and there was a bunch of people that, like, I read about that talked about him, like, his neighbor and, like, some of his friends, and everyone was like, he was really nice, and someone said he seemed normal, and the other one said that, you know, on his way out, he wished them a Merry Christmas and everything. Yeah, so, like, he was just, like, a seemingly normal guy, and then all of a sudden he just snapped.
That's what scares me about people. You never know, like, if you give somebody a wrong look and they can just snap. That's what scares me about road rage.
Oh, like, my gosh, I know. Like, you really never
wanna,
know.
Like, right, like, I don't want to, like, flip anybody off ever, you know. That's just, like, not really me.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, also, you don't want somebody to, like, follow you home and just snap. Like,
I know.
People are crazy.
Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
No, but I want to watch it.
Oh, you should. It just kind of reminded me of, like, a part in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
You should watch it. It's really good.
Yeah,
I love Quentin Tarantino. But yeah, I agree. I was even thinking that the other day. I was at the DMV because I needed to get my tabs renewed, and the line was, like, all the way out the door.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, seriously, like, into the parking lot. Like, the line was so long. But everyone was standing, like, you know, 6 feet away from each other and everything, so it made it look longer. But I was there for, you know, a good hour at least. But anyway, there was this guy behind me in line. He was kind of, like, an older guy, you know, just, like, dirty mask on. He had, like, overall jeans. Like, he was just
disheveled.
It was the dirty mask that really, like, set me off, or like, off put me or whatever.
How dirty was it? Like, it looked like,
there was, like, the ground. Yeah, it literally looked like that. And he was, like, just talking to me.
Oh.
Like, and I'm trapped in line with him for, like, an hour. But he was actually really nice, but at first I was just gonna be like, you're too close to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I'm like, you're too close. Like, don't be next to me. But that same thought went through my mind, like, yeah, I don't know.
This guy might follow you to your car.
Yeah, because I live really close to the DMV, so I was like, he might, like, follow me home and kill me.
I had, like, a customer get pissed off at me at my job one time, and then I was really scared to come home, or not to come home, but to, like, come out to my car, because I thought, like, what if he waits for me? You just never know.
Yeah. Ugh, scary. So just to wrap it up, I'll talk about, I know this is kind of a short one today, but I just want to say all the people who died under this guy's
heinous ass.
Yeah. So Sylvia Ortega Pardo, that was his ex-wife. She died. Both her parents, Alicia and Joseph, died. Sylvia's brother, Charles. Charles' wife, Sherry. James, which was Sylvia's brother, and his wife, Teresa. And then Alicia, which was Sylvia's sister. And then Michael Oritz, who was 17 years old. And that was Alicia Oritz's son. So, sad.
I hope they're all resting in peace.
Yeah, very sad. And I hope the survivors are okay.
I know. Mentally. I hope they're doing okay.
Yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah. So that was just kind of a short one today. What do you got for us?
All right. So it's actually kind of good that yours is a little shorter today, because I have quite the topic today. Today I'm going to be talking about an installation art piece.
Awesome.
I don't think I've talked about any installation pieces before. And that's, like, a piece, if you don't know, it's an art piece that occupies up a space.
Wasn't it, what was that guy that did the glass stuff?
Oh.
What was his name? James? Charles? James, I don't know.
James Charles.
Oh, I don't know. One of those.
I
think it was Charles something. But you know who I'm talking about, right?
No.
He, like, slithered through glass, and then he also,
the guy,
like,
that I covered. Yeah, yeah. He did performance. Chris Burden. Oh, performance Chris Burden. Yeah, sorry. He did performance art.
He did have that installation where he, like, stood under that glass pane, though, right?
Yeah. He did have some installations, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
That had, like, body art or performance art incorporated into it.
Uh-huh.
But today we are just going to be talking about installation. Not just, like, installation art in general, but one, like, really famous installation art piece that mm-hmm. is called Woman House.
Okay.
So I've been really excited to talk about this one. I don't know why. It's just like the whole idea of this Woman House thing, it's very like eerie and interesting to me. And it like takes you back into history a little bit to look at things from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just jump right into it. So this art piece is involved in the feminist art movement.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be talking a little bit about that today. And that began in the late 1960s, and this was also a time when there were a lot of anti-war demonstrations. Mm-hmm. We had the civil rights movement going on, LGBT rights movements were happening. So there was like also this push to make some much-needed changes to society in general, and then enter the feminist art movement. So the whole premise behind the feminist art movement was to basically rewrite what was a very male-dominated art history. And we've spoken about that on here before, so I won't go too much at length about that, because I spoke about that in episode 2 when I talked about the Gorilla Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also a feminist art group, except they formed in the 1980s, but they also talked about like the huge imbalances of right. art history. So, you know, there's even like past female artists who worked under male name pseudonyms, because they knew if they went under their female name, their work was just going to be dismissed and not taken seriously.
I think that happened in the theater a lot, too.
Like
women wrote plays and stuff like that, so that the playhouses would actually, like, show their play.
Isn't, like, Shakespeare, there's a conspiracy theory that it was actually a woman who wrote the plays? Or am I just, like, making that up?
Oh, I don't know. I've never heard that before, but that's interesting. I don't think it was, but it is interesting. Because wasn't Shakespeare, like, actually in some of his plays?
Oh, was he?
I don't know.
I don't know, but maybe we can cover
I'm literally making that up. Like, I'm literally, like, just saying anything. Like, that
honestly,
doesn't have any merit
really
to it at all.
I don't know anything about Shakespeare. We'll have to cover him sometime. I'd be interested to learn more about him.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, like, you know, the female artists, they have a rough, like we've talked about in past episodes, especially at this time in the 1960s.
Yeah.
So, this is a quote that I found interesting, but Susan Lacey, and she is an American performance artist and contemporary artist, and she was involved in the feminist art movement. And in a quote from her, she declared that the goal of the feminist art movement was to influence culture attitudes and transform stereotypes.
Nice.
And the Woman House installation that I'm talking about addresses a lot of stereotypes about women, so that's a really interesting part about this piece.
Sweet.
But the feminist art movement created a lot of opportunities and just like a space for women and minority artists as well, and also helped head the identity art and like activist art movement that was seen in the 1980s, hence the Gorilla Girls.
Right.
So this kind of like paved the way.
Awesome.
So yeah, so Woman House is installation piece I'm going to be focusing on, and this is a large installation that was organized by artists Judy Chicago and Miriam Shapiro.
Okay.
And so I'm going to give a little background on these two artists. So Judy Chicago was born in 1939 in Chicago, Illinois. She was known for being an American painter, a sculptor, and most famously an installation artist. And she's also one of the pioneer artists in the feminist art and body art movements, which began in the 1970s. And so Judy Chicago's aim was to reflect the lives and contributions of women in art history. And she wanted women to really consider their role as artists and reflect on how their life experience as a woman affects their artwork.
Hmm. So when you say body art movement, mm-hmm. like what do you mean by that?
Oh boy. So body art is one of my favorite art mediums. It's not dancing, because that's a different art in itself. And one of my favorite art pieces is actually a body art piece, but it's using your body to convey, like, a conceptual meaning.
Okay.
It's definitely more of a conceptual art medium where it relies on you to really think about things than being more of like a visually pleasing aesthetic.
Kind of like that one picture where all the ladies are like together making a skull.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that would be body art, I would say. Okay. For sure.
Cool, because I didn't know, because like that can mean anything. It can mean like, you know how some people like paint their bodies and that's body art, you know, so I wasn't sure. But that's really cool.
I'll definitely cover body art sometime because I love body art, and there's definitely some body art pieces from this time period in the 70s that are super cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she was a really big body art person as well. Cool. But yeah, so she posed in her work one of the greatest challenges to modern art, which at the time was just super focused on like formalism and technique rather than any like personal narrative.
Right.
And she felt, you know, women have a lot of personal narrative that's being written out.
Yeah.
So there was sort of like an artistic hierarchy that deemed like what was considered high art or worthy art. And Judy Chicago felt as though feminine arts such as like embroidery and needlework and quilting and beading, all of these were deemed as not real art.
Which is crazy because that stuff's super hard.
Oh, yeah. And super time consuming. And
right.
I think like everything is an art. So
yeah.
I don't know how people can just turn their nose up at that and just declare it as not art.
Right.
So I understand her frustration. So she just wanted to like celebrate the feminine arts and alter the conditions under which contemporary art was produced. And she also wanted to draw attention to the achievements of women artists who have been written out of history or underrepresented. And she was like seen as an educator and also an organizer of these big projects.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these big projects is called The Dinner Party. Have you heard of The Dinner Party before? It's like a big installation piece.
I've never heard of it, no.
It's, I love this piece. It's like, it's very large. So this is probably her most famous piece, which is why I feel it's important to talk about it. And she helped orchestrate this, but I think a lot of people helped make this come to life. Because
okay.
It is so big. But it was made in 1979. And I like this because it's so interesting. The concept is to put spotlight on women's underrepresentation through art history, like I said. But it's like sort of a symbolic visual representation of women throughout history. And I love history,
mm-hmm.
like I've said before. So basically, there's like three large tables and they all converge together to make a large triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And then among this triangle table setup, there's 39 really elaborate place settings for 39 historical famous women.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
And so like each place setting is like personalized to them too. Like there's a Georgia O'Keeffe place setting, a Frida Kahlo place setting, and you can tell like who it belongs to because it's, you know, there's like key visual representation of their like achievements or personality. So it's really interesting. And also she like uses a lot of embroidery and needlework and beading and quilting, just like I mentioned earlier, because she was all about showing like this is real art,
right,
and has substance to it. And she also used in this work a lot of like vaginal imagery,
okay,
which like you know, because she was all about that female empowerment, you know.
Yeah, I feel like Georgia O'Keeffe kind of did that too with the flower paintings.
Yeah,
she definitely
made
it represent like
I think if I remember correctly, and I don't want to misspeak in case I'm wrong, but I think some people criticized Judy Chicago for using female genitalia basically in Georgia O'Keeffe's play setting, because I think Judy Chicago was kind of talking about when she showed that or symbolizing the flowers in Georgia O'Keeffe's work.
Exactly.
But
like, that's exactly what Georgia O'Keeffe was going for, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
I heard that Georgia O'Keeffe was like pissy. Again, I could be wrong, but I heard she was pissy about that. She was like, okay, Judy Chicago, I get that. Like, you are super about the vagina imagery shenanigans, but mine are flowers. Like, don't get it twisted. That's
Ooh,
the impression
really?
I thought, but I could be wrong.
Oh, okay.
I'll have to look, because I've also wanted to talk about Georgia O'Keeffe in the future, because she's one of my faves, but I could be wrong. But yeah, so, like, each place setting was very personalized to the people that it represented.
Okay.
The place settings were included for people who went down in history or just like mythical figures too.
Cool.
And so like Sacagawea was one of them, the Empress Theodora of Byzantium, and just like a bunch of really cool, powerful female figures.
Cool.
And so, yeah, and then Judy Chicago went on to become the co-founder of the feminist art program at Cal State Fresno, and that is where she orchestrated the construction of Women House. And then, so speaking a little bit about Miriam Shapiro, she was also an American painter, sculptor, and she did printmaking.
Cool.
Yeah, I love printmaking.
I want to talk a little bit more about printmaking sometime.
Oh, totally. Printmaking's one of my faves. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen too much of Miriam Shapiro's printmaking works, but she does have really awesome like textile fabric pieces.
Cool.
Which I'll get a little more into. She was actually born in Canada on November 15th, 1923, and then she actually died in 2015 in New York. And I just really love this quote from her that I'll read. She said, "I wanted to validate the traditional activities of women, to connect myself with the unknown women artists who made quilts, who had done the invisible women's work of civilization. I wanted to acknowledge them and to honor them." Which I thought was super sweet.
Mm-hmm, that's awesome.
So her medium of choice often included materials of marginalized types of domestic craft. So she celebrated women in her work and used a lot of feminine, well, feminine-deemed art mediums,
right,
you could say.
Like needlework and
yeah,
stuff like that.
Yeah, quilts, fabric work,
yeah,
things like that. So she joined forces with Judy Chicago for the creation of the feminist art program at Cal State Fresno.
Okay.
And she was also one of the main orchestrators of Women House. And so she was particularly interested in using fabric textiles and creating abstract compositions by sewing pieces together. And she was also heavily influenced by the pattern and decoration movement. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to rebuttal against all the art snobs at the time by, like, embracing and celebrating decorative artwork as fine art that has, like, substance to it and is not inferior to other fine art male-dominated
right, mediums. Like portraits and landscapes.
Right, exactly. So, like, art snobs at the time would say that decorative art was just, like, craft, you know, and not important. So she wanted to, like, kind of fight them. And Shapiro wanted to use art mediums that were deemed low quality only and kind of show, like, look what I can do with what you call low quality art. So
right,
her pieces were super detailed, intricate, and just, like, these stitched together, like, beautifully colorful textile pieces.
Awesome.
So, yeah, she was a really cool person. But now getting into Women House, now that you know about the two orchestrators of this project.
Mm-hmm.
The Women House installation and performance art piece started from the female art program at Cal State Fresno. And initially, Cal State was really reluctant to take on Chicago and Shapiro's vision for this female-centered arts program. And that's partly because Chicago had these, like, different teaching ideas, which included that having, like, a very non-authoritarian approach and more of, like, a team-centered, you know, approach where everybody is kind of equal. And Cal State ended up going with her idea, and they launched the program. So they launched the program, but then they realized that they didn't really have the space on the school grounds for a building for this art program to take place in. And so this sparked the idea for Judy Chicago and Miriam Shapiro to start this collaborative group project with the students to create what was called the Women House installation. And this was actually off campus.
Okay.
And so the whole idea was to represent the symbolic fusion of women and houses, as well as other ideologies that society places on women. And at the time, a lot of women were told that they had to be housewives,
mm-hmm,
and they were expected to be a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the feminist art program rented an abandoned Victorian house in Hollywood.
Cool.
And got to work. Yeah, I can't wait to show you pictures. It's super cool. So the program really relied heavily on group cooperation, and that's because of Chicago's teaching style.
Mm-hmm.
And the students were known to, like, sit in a circle at the beginning of each meeting, and they would take turns, like, each sharing their personal thoughts and ideas, and they would, like, have selected topics surrounding around just, like, women's issues going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody got a say and got to have their own piece in this project.
It's really cool.
Right. I love that. Like, group effort, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good way to teach.
I think that's a good way to teach, too. I really can appreciate her teaching style. Mm-hmm. But her teaching style did run into a little bit of issues later on, mm-hmm. which I'll tell you more about later. But the goal was to create, like, a really nourishing learning environment for growth.
Okay.
And to share the voice of, like, each of the artists. And altogether, there were, like, 30-plus artists that were students in this. Cool. And they all collaborated on this together. So that's a lot of collaboration.
Yeah.
And they really wanted to validate each woman's thoughts and experiences. And it was also centered around the experience of being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And Chicago and Shapiro wanted their students to overcome the stereotypes of womanhood, to have their own voice, become assertive and ambitious, because there's this whole idea that women in society are expected to be less assertive and mm-hmm. less submissive. Ambitious.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they wanted that to really push them to create something that they thought was not within their ability. They wanted the students to really, like, envision themselves as working people who were more confident with their newfound knowledge and ability to carry out really hard manual labor. And they also had to use, like, power tools. They had to, like, build this thing from the ground up, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of pressure on these girls because they had never done anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chicago and Shapiro said that, this is a quote, "Society fails women by not demanding excellence from them." So basically, this means they really wanted to push them to show the girls their own potential and show they're capable of doing anything that they set their mind to, which I think that's really great. Like, how many classes have you taken where, you know, they don't care just about teaching you the material. Mm-hmm. They want to, like, push you to change as a person, like,
yeah,
life lessons that you'll carry out for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think their teaching style is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But the original idea of Woman House is credited to a lady named Paula Harper, and she was an art historian for California Institute of Arts, specifically for the feminist art program. And her idea was to use the connotations of a domestic household to represent in an artistic experience what women experience in society.
Okay.
And so there's this quote that goes along with this. "Woman House became the repository of daydreams women have as they wash, bake, cook, sew, clean, and iron their lives away." Because that really was the lives of a majority of women at mm-hmm. this time in history, right, in the U.S. So they started the construction process, and when they first got the abandoned mansion, it was in super rough shape. The students had to do a lot of hard work,
mm-hmm.
and the house was, like, massive. It had 17 bedrooms, and so the construction process went from November 1971 to January 1972.
Okay.
So this is a long, this isn't just like a one semester class. This is like a long time investment for these students.
Mm-hmm.
And the mansion was really old, and the lease agreement that the feminist art program held said that the house would be demolished after their time with it. So I can't imagine putting so much work into this knowing it's not gonna last, you know?
Oh my gosh, that's just so, I would just,
it's kind of mean to, like, make him do all this work and then knowing it's going to be demolished. So
yeah,
I thought that was interesting to include. But the students did have to employ the help of professional painters just to paint the exterior, but everything else, like from putting up walls, installing windows, redoing the floor, that was all them. And they even, like, enlisted the help of electricians to come over and instruct them on how to do the wiring and electrical stuff themselves.
Oh, nice. So they, like, instead of having the electricians do it, they had them teach them how to do it so that they could do it themselves.
Right. Because, like, this whole construction process was showing, it was a part of the artistic message, showing that women are capable of doing what men do. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, show me how to do it, give me the tools, and I can do it too.
Right.
So I thought that was really interesting. But the women were really struggling, and they really pushed their limits, and eventually they started butting heads with each other, which is, I could foresee that happening.
Yeah.
Because they were just, like, really frustrated. They're doing something they've never done before. They were working long days, which they were never really accustomed to. And they began feeling like the demands being placed on them were impossible and not realistic, and started expressing that they thought they were going to fail.
Aww.
Which is sad. That's what, you know, Judy Chicago wanted them to overcome, was that feeling like,
right,
I can't do it. So they start getting frustrated. And I found some quotes from some of the participants on their perspective from this experience. And this is 25 years later, so I'll share. I found this really interesting. So Camille Gray was a participant, and she said, "Put 30 women together and see what happens. A nightmare."
Aw, I hate that.
I hate that too. Like, why does it have to be that way?
Yeah.
Robin Mitchell said, "It was simultaneously one of the best and worst experiences of my life."
I could see that.
Totally. Yeah. Mira Shore said, "I left the program after 1 year because of my disagreements and because I wanted to experience the school outside the confines of the program. I have avoided group feminism since then."
Ugh.
I know. So that kind of sucks. I'm sorry.
It's just kind of sad.
I know. Like, it turned... So I guess it turned her away from it. It was just a very mixed feeling experience. Mm-hmm. And then one more quote is from Nancy Udelman, and she said, "Looking back 25 years later, I have mixed feelings about the feminist art program. We had something really incredible and unique, and somehow we could knock it beyond personalities and create a lasting support system."
Oh, man.
Isn't that sad?
So like, sad. All of them were sad.
Right. Like, they came together, and it was a great concept, but they just, like, butted heads and got in their
like,
own way.
Yeah, they just kind of, like, fell into this...
Into the
stereotype,
stereotype, right?
That, like, you know...
Women can't cooperate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was kind of a downer to read.
Interesting, though.
Very interesting. And I'll give, like, their final thoughts, too, at the end. But now I want to get into what is in this house. So fast forward, the house is created.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is 1972 now. And Woman House was comprised of many feminist art installations. And they also did hold feminist art performances as well. And so Woman House was centered around the white, cisgender, heterosexual, and middle-class experience of being a woman in the early 1970s. So that's very specific.
So they didn't have any... Well, okay. They didn't have any black women. They didn't have any gay women. Nothing like that.
Right. And I appreciate that they really included that in the description. Like, hey, we understand this is not everybody's experience, but this is what this group... you know,
mm-hmm.
says that they experience, you know, obviously if you, you know, come from a different culture or a different, you know,
sexual
orientation, you know, your experience might be really different, but
yeah, it was probably, I don't know, because this is in California, right? At a
college. This is in California.
Well, it's off campus,
but it is in the 1970s.
Yeah.
So, you know, people were living more similarly to each other. You know what I mean? Like, there were more people that felt like they had to fit in this certain box of what you were supposed to be like. You know, women had to be housewives. Not all of them,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of them did feel the pressure to be a housewife. And so
this should have had some diversity in there. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, it would be nice to have some diversity, but I can appreciate that they say, hey, we acknowledge we're not being
absolutely.
Totally inclusive. But their aim was really just to, like, make a statement about women's experience in society.
Yeah.
And so, the first one I'll talk about is Nurturant Kitchen. So this is one of the rooms within Woman House. Each room is kind of a different installation.
Oh, cool.
And I will I'll walk you through what each of these look like so you can kind of visualize. So Nurturant Kitchen was, you know, in a kitchen, obviously, and their aim was to make a statement by using the kitchen because that's been deemed the woman's space, and they wanted to use it as a feminist artwork to criticize the male-dominated patriarchy and highlight women's issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so the statement was pushed further by the fact that they used a mansion that they built themselves. So Nurturant Kitchen, you walk in, and... the whole goal is to highlight the dehumanizing aspects of a woman's role of a nurturer in the kitchen. And there's this, like, really ominous sight of multiple food plates under these line of light bulbs. So you walk in, there's this long table, and there's all these food plates lined up. And it has this factory workers assembly line look to it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's super interesting to look at.
Like, they're just a worker that's all they do is just fill the plates
and
whatnot.
Yeah, they fill the
plate,
they push out, because that's their job as a nurturer in society because they're a woman. So you have that eerie thing on one side of the wall. And this is like a narrow room leading into the kitchen. And then on the other side of this is another display called Aprons in Kitchen. And this is a display on the opposite wall, and it basically has like multiple aprons hung up on the wall. Only the aprons have like female body parts, such as like breasts and whatnot, like stitched onto the front. And this is so that, in a sense, a woman can take off her bodily features once she is done with her house chores, implicating that her body is integral to her role in society.
Right.
So lots of like conceptual stuff going on here.
That's really cool.
Right. Like, definitely check out the pictures this week on our pod post that we make. Because,
oh, I'm looking at the picture now. It's really cool. We'll post that.
Yeah. Yeah. Super eerie feeling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then so when you further walk into the kitchen, you walk into this completely pink kitchen. Mm-hmm. It's like Pepto-Bismol pink. And when I say completely pink, I mean every inch of it's pink. There's no normal color. And when you walk in, you see these 3D forms that resemble over-easy eggs. And they're all over the walls, and they even go up onto the ceiling. And as you walk into the room, the eggs kind of start gradually transforming into more of a breast shape.
Cool.
Yeah, it's super interesting, which I can obviously see the connection, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes, you know, the connection that a woman's expected role as a nurturer by using the kitchen imagery food with the it resembling women's breasts. So
again, the connection between, you know, a woman's body like being a direct connection to like her role in society.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's super interesting when you're looking at just like the eggs, because they do look like sunny side up eggs at first, but you can see them slowly transform into like a breast shape.
Like on this left wall here. Like,
yeah.
They're totally a breast, but then as they go up a little bit, they get flatter like eggs, and then it's eggs on the top.
Which is totally interesting, because like, as a woman, like, the imagery does look similar. Like an over-easy egg.
I know, I never noticed that before, and now I'm never gonna not notice that when I make eggs.
Oh god, yeah. So, yeah, just really interesting. And also, it was cool because when people were touring this installation, they walk in, you know, they see the eggs, they're like, okay, they're eggs, and then they start transforming into breasts, and all of a sudden people become uncomfortable, and they're like, ew, they're like disgusted and saying like, that's inappropriate. And so it's interesting seeing people's reaction to this room when you go back and like watch the videos of this.
Ugh, that's such a thing too, where like, I don't want to get into it that much, but like, just the fact that...
It's just a body part, man.
Like, the fact that like, men have an equal chest, you know what I mean, with the
men
same
breast
nipples.
Tissue too,
yeah, and,
right.
And it's like, that's not inappropriate, but like, it's inappropriate for what, like, because
right,
you know,
or it becomes
like
disgusting,
or like, yeah, it's like, what, like, I don't know, it's just, it's the same thing, it's just a double standard that
needs
to be looked at closer, I think.
Totally. So like, so yeah, this room really gets me. And then, so, like, you walk past the kitchen, and then there's the dining room. And when you enter the room, you see this, like, heavily decorated room, and there's a large circular dining table under this chandelier. And the crown molding in the room has this really ornate painted fruit decoration, and that goes along the whole entire room. And there's also this really large mural on the wall, and that's based on a 19th century still life by Anna Peel.
Okay.
And behind the large circular dinner table, that's where this like big mural is. So it's a super elaborate decorative room, which Miriam Shapiro actually was one of the artists that helped create this room. And, you know, she really liked to highlight the decorative aspects of feminine art. So a very decorative room. On the table is this abundance of lifelike sculptured food, including like a big ham, a turkey, a pecan pie, a salad bowl, and like all of these pieces are very beautifully sculpted and detailed and intricate. It's really cool to see. And then there's these like intricate place settings on the table, and it all comes together and it looks like super elaborate. And it's supposed to create this like bountiful, romantic, and abundant scene. And so they create this like energy, I guess, in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the most collaborative installation in the house, and it took 7 women to create.
Wow. It's gorgeous, though.
Yeah, it's very
that
1970s
like
gorgeous.
Real food. Yeah.
And actually, if you look really close in the picture, you can definitely see some of the imagery kind of looking very
yeah, like
vaginally.
The, yeah, like the watermelon.
I don't know, like, how to say that
in the back.
Yeah, so like they definitely, you know, sneak in little imagery pieces that it's one thing, but it totally looks like genitalia or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like snuck in all throughout the house. But anyways,
cool.
You leave the dining room. Then there's the installation called Bridal Staircase. And this was created by artist Kathy Huberland. And when you look up this ornately decorated staircase, there's lots of like garlands and flowers everywhere and intricate fabrics, very feminine feel to it. And you see at the top a very creepy and unsettling like vintage life-size doll mannequin that's all in like bridal getup. And it's really cool because it's like, you know, 1970s bridal getup when you look at the pictures.
Cute.
Yeah, it's really cute. But she's meant to appear like she's descending down the staircase. And then so moving on, there's the crocheted room. And this piece was called the crocheted environment. And this room is super cool. So this work features a canopy, essentially. It hangs from the ceiling.
Oh, that is sweet.
Yeah, super cool. Definitely check out this picture,
it's
too.
It's like macrame times a million.
Yeah, it's all white crochet, kind of macrame style work. And there's all these like intricate patterns and it's gigantic size. You can like fit one person in it. I think in the picture I included, it's one lady just like chilling, vibing there on the floor.
Looks like you could even fit maybe another person in there too.
Yeah, it's pretty like big. Pretty big, and you can stand up in it and everything. It's pretty large, and it's meant to resemble a womb shelter safe atmosphere, which is so comforting. Like yeah. I would chill in there, I feel like. And
it's really cool.
It's cute, right?
Yeah, kind of looks like spiderweb though a little bit.
Yeah, I could
towards
see
the
that.
Top. Yeah.
Because it definitely has, like, different patterns, and, yeah, you'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it's really cool, though. I like it a lot.
And, like, the cool part about it, too, is, so the rest of the room that this thing hangs in is, it's entirely painted black. And so this really makes, like, the white crochet centerpiece stand out, mm-hmm. and it almost feels like everything else is just, like, black going into space, and
that's
you're just
so
having
cool.
this moment in this crochet womb thing. And there's, like, this light bulb that hangs down from the ceiling right in the center of the womb to kind of give off this warm, comforting light.
Yeah.
So, a very nurturing, like, I feel like this is a very positive feeling room,
mm-hmm.
you know? I love it. This next one I love, too, a lot. So, this one's called Leah's Room, and this was created by artist Karen LeCocq, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Nancy Udelman. And so, the whole idea is behind this fictional character named Leah, and this is a character that's based on this aging sex worker character from a novel titled Sherry by Colette. And so this installation is a bedroom that is completely like retro Pepto-Bismol pink color everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this is supposed to be like Leah's bedroom. And inside the room, there's this very, like, detailed old-school vanity with cosmetics strewn across it.
Mm-hmm.
And it very much reminds me of, like, you know the scene in Greece when they're having that, like, girly slumber party?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of gives me those vibes a little bit.
Yeah. Have you seen A Little Princess?
No.
Oh, it's
I
so
don't
cute.
Think so.
It kind of reminds me of that, too. Like, the big mirror and...
Yeah, just
kind
like
of, like,
the
canopy-looking thing over
look.
It. Yeah.
Totally. It's very, like... It's very, you know, 70s, 60s, even 50s-ish looking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, inside Leah's bedroom... Actually, this is interesting. So this is kind of like a performance piece as well because Karen LeCocq, who is one of the artists of this piece,
yeah.
she actually performed as Leah in this space almost on like a daily basis when they were doing tours. So her performance involved her, she's dressing up in kind of like this, I don't know, this like dress and like fancy getup. And then she sits at this old school vanity and she's like meticulously and obsessively looking in the mirror and applying cosmetics to her face and just like doing it super obsessively. And then she'll like aggressively start removing the makeup only to just start reapplying it all over again. And it just goes in an endless cycle and it's meant to represent the pain of aging and the pressure put on women to desperately try to maintain their unrealistic beauty standards.
Wow.
I know, right? It's, like, pretty deep stuff.
Yeah.
And so the character Leah goes through continuous and painstaking efforts to maintain her beauty as she deteriorates as she grows older. And this is all to keep the attention of this certain man in her life.
Mm-hmm.
So that one really resonated with me. I don't know why. It's just, like... I also have to put myself in the shoes of the performer, Karen LeCocq. Because she had to, like, reapply this makeup and take it off.
I was just going to say, like, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, like, I would hate that.
And, like, when you take off your makeup, it doesn't feel good.
No, honestly, if you wear a full face of makeup and you take it, it feels good to, like, take it off and have a bare face. But the process is not, like, very comfortable. You're wiping stuff off your face. You're, like,
scrubbing your eyes.
Right. You're scrubbing your skin. So I can't imagine, like, doing this over and over again.
Right. And it's not like she's using, like, Neutrogena makeup wipes or something. Right. She's probably using, like, micellar water or whatever that stuff's called. Or just something, you know, because it's in the 60s or whatever. Or 70s.
So her makeup was, like, 70s style. Maybe it wasn't, like, as dramatic as people do today. Still. But still, like, and by just, like, I feel like I get that it was necessary for her to do that for the performance because she's trying to, like, articulate this endless cycle that happens. Like, you wake up, you put your makeup on just to leave the house, and then because you feel pressured because of society.
Right.
I mean,
and then you come home and you take it off and you wake up in the morning and you do it again.
Right, exactly. And I have to, like, include this little blurb. I'm, like, a huge makeup person myself. And honestly, like, even in quarantine, when I'm not leaving the house, I'll do my makeup. So just because a woman's wearing makeup doesn't mean it's to impress people.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, there is definitely still a societal pressure to look a certain way in order to be accepted.
Yeah.
Or to keep a man or something. So I find that piece super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the next piece, I'll move on, is called The Shoe Closet. And this was created by Beth Backenheimer. And for this work, the artist collected hundreds of women's shoes, which were each crafted and painted and styled for this closet display. And the closet is meant to feature comically extravagant shoes. And it's in, like, such large quantities to comment on a woman's desperate attempt to look fashion forward at all times. Mm-hmm. So this one's really interesting. And also, like, on making the shoes look very comical, there's one shoe pair in here that's called, like, the spike shoe. And it literally has, like, spikes on the bottom of the heels. So I don't know. It's just, like, very quirky feeling with this piece. Then we get to the linen closet in the hallway. So the linen closet installation was created by Sandy Orgel.
Oh, this one's so cool.
So cool and so creepy and so, ugh, like, the picture just gets me.
Mm-hmm.
So in this work, you see this vintage looking, obviously there's, I'm saying these are all vintage, but that's because this is from the 1970s.
Right.
But I'm just describing it for you guys listening.
Right.
So you see this, like, vintage looking female mannequin, and she's installed and essentially, like, integrated into the linen closet.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's shelves that are, you know,
going
having,
through,
like,
her body.
Yeah, they're, like, bisecting her body into multiple pieces. And then alongside her are, like, folded towels on these shelves that are, like, bisecting her.
Yeah. It's just super, she's got, like, weird. A probably, like, a 20-inch waist.
Her
proportions are, like, really unrealistic.
Totally. Yeah. Like, I just live in the closet and do laundry. Like, this is... I feel like this piece is saying, like, this is a part of me. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
I'm trapped in here.
Totally. You definitely get a trapped feeling looking at this piece. Like, it's very unsettling.
Yeah. It's really cool, though.
Super cool. And I think you'll really like this next one, too. Because this next one, the aesthetic of this bathroom is nuts. So this is one of the most famous installations in this house, and it's called Lipstick Bathroom, and it's by Camille Gray. And so this is a bathroom that is completely, like, a bright, shiny red because everything's meant to look like it's coated in a bright red lipstick, and it's super eerie looking. Absolutely everything is covered, like, no other surface is showing.
Wait, and it's all actually covered with actual lipstick?
You know, that, like, I had a hard time confirming. I do think... So lipstick was used in the creation of this, but I do feel like they used another material.
Like paint.
Like a paint with a certain viscous and shininess to it to look like lipstick.
It really does look like lipstick.
It totally does. That's why it's like, wait, did they really use lipstick?
I'm sure they did a little.
Yeah. So they did have over 200 plastic lipstick components, obviously the same red shade, like strewn all over, like, the sink countertop and all over the bathroom. So they did have, like, a lot of red lipstick in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of, like, when girls write on mirrors with lipstick, like, in movies. Like,
yeah.
Like, in, I think that happened in Black Swan or something with Natalie Portman, where she, like, writes in the mirror with lipstick. I don't know. It's just a very eerie feeling to me. And so this visual embodies the getting ready process that women undergo before they leave the house. And it has this chaotic, overwhelming feeling, and that's meant to represent the feeling that women get when they're trying to meet society's standards. Mm-hmm. And this whole idea that there's lipstick covering every single surface symbolizes the time-consuming and painstaking efforts it takes to be accepted by society.
Mm-hmm.
And just, like, the time it takes that you spend in the bathroom every single day
right.
before you leave the house. So that piece is super cool.
Yeah.
There's actually a few bathrooms in this house. I'm going to talk about two more bathrooms here. So one bathroom is called the menstruation bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is by Judy Chicago herself. And so this is a separate bathroom installation, and it contrasts a lot against the first one. And it has, like, really bright white walls. It looks kind of like a regular bathroom. Only there's, like, gauze everywhere. There's gauze, like, covering the shelves. And you can see boxes of feminine hygiene products just piled everywhere, like, overflowing. And a part of this display is a small bathroom trash can that's just, like, overflowing with, like, fake bloodied tampons.
Mm-hmm.
And
pads. I can see pads right, hanging
pads,
up, too.
Pads, like, the whole works. Just, mm-hmm. like, overflowing and, like, going onto the floor. And she makes this look, like, very exaggerated, almost like a murder scene, like, bright red blood.
Yeah.
Because, like, men, I think, are very nervous. I mean, not all men. I don't want to speak for all men, obviously. But I think a lot of men feel uncomfortable with the idea of just, like, blood. And as a woman, you feel this pressure that you have to hide your, you know, feminine hygiene products. And, oh, my gosh, I don't even want them to see the wrapper, uh-huh. you know, because then they could know. So this comments on that because it's, like, a contrast to that. It's everywhere. You can't not see it. And so it's meant to represent a woman's hidden secret that cannot be covered up.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that one was interesting. I'll definitely include the pics for that one too.
Yep.
So this next piece is one of the last three that I have to talk about tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the third bathroom. This one's called Nightmare Bathroom by Robin Schiff. And in this installation, so there's a bathroom and then there's this bathtub in which this woman figure, it looks like it may be like a mannequin or a sculpture. It kind of like gives me Jeepers Creepers vibes when, like, you know, Justin Long goes in the Jeepers Creepers house lair and he sees all the bodies. Super creepy
looking.
It's
very like wax figurey, but it's like all one color, so it's not like, you know what I mean? It's just creepy.
It's very unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. But she's, like, in the bathtub, right? And then so she's submerged in the water, but the water is really made of, like, a ton of loose sand. And so this installation is symbolizing the vulnerability that women feel and even have to face in their own home. And to further this message, you can see a silhouette of a snake on the floor. And the snake's meant to look like it's making its way, slithering into the bathtub. And this imagery embodies the fear that anybody could intrude at any moment. And there's also this really heavy, like, suffocating feeling from the sand, like, anchoring the woman in the tub. It just, like, this piece definitely has an overall just, like, heavy feeling in it.
Yeah, definitely.
And
even the, like, body language of the woman in the tub,
totally.
Like, the shoulders are just, like, tense, you know?
Yeah, definitely it doesn't look like a relaxing bubble bath.
No.
Like, she looks like she can't even enjoy herself in the comfort of her own home. Like,
mm-hmm.
it totally looks like that. Yeah, this is another one of my favorite pieces. It's so simple, but that's the thing that I've kind of realized the more I've looked at art. Like, I've become way more into the conceptual art pieces that sometimes don't require a lot to really have a strong message.
Right.
So this piece is super cool. This next piece I'll talk about also has a really cool message. So this is In the Dollhouse Room, created by Miriam Shapiro. And so this is In the Dollhouse Room is the dollhouse, and it's a miniature small model house that looks like a little toy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's comprised of six rooms, and one room serves as the artist's studio. And it features a nude male model that's on a pedestal, and he
mm-hmm.
has bananas at his feet. And this is to reverse the role in which usually women are the subject of nude modeling for artworks, and they're often objectified. So in this instance, Shapiro features herself in her work as like a small woman figurine in this dollhouse, and she takes on the role of the artist, and the male in the scene is subjected to being gazed at and objectified. And the objectification of this is shown through, like, the references to male genitalia, because you have the bananas at his feet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, like, you know, referencing that. And also, like, I didn't know how to word this, but he also happens to have, like, a little, I wrote in my notes, a little erect wiener, which, like, I just, it's awkward to talk about. I don't know why. It's just, like, a normal thing, but, like, yeah. I feel like I have to include it because it's obviously hinting at the fact that this is meant to be an objectifying kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So that's happening in one of the dollhouse rooms. And then in another room, a woman figurine sits at a vanity table and the other figurines in the dollhouse are all like monstrous. So for example, like inside the nursery room, the baby in the crib is replaced with like a monstrous looking thing. There's also, if you look, a grizzly bear outside that's, like, peering into the house, which is super creepy. And there's a group of 10 creepy men figurines that peer into the kitchen window. Also, there's a rattlesnake in one of the rooms just, like, chilling on the floor. The idea is to contrast the theme and safety that you feel
in your own home.
In your own home, yeah. Yeah. So, like, it contrasts that with the idea that there's monsters, like, lurking inside the walls. So basically, it turns an idyllic domestic household into, like, a horror house.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. That one was kind of
ooh, there's, like, a spider weird in there, too, and
it's really creepy and unsettling. Kind yeah of reminds me of Coraline, in a way.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So this next one is interesting. This one's called Lingerie Pillows. I think this one could totally be, like, something that I could see sold on Instagram or something. It's kind of an interesting idea. So the creator was Sherry Brody, and she took pillows and basically just sewed lingerie, like bras and underwear, onto them. And then she displayed all these pillows on a tabletop. And so a little interesting story is when Miriam Shapiro was giving a tour of Women House, in the dollhouse room, this is where the lingerie pillows are set up, and a male curator picks up one of the pillows. And then he gets super embarrassed because he realizes it's in fact made of women's lingerie. And everybody kind of like laughs at him because he's super embarrassed, including Shapiro at the time. She like laughed too. But then looking back, she said she wished that she had used that as like a teachable moment to question his embarrassment, and
yeah,
aversion to like something so feminine and delicate. Which I get why you'd be a little embarrassed. I mean, maybe not in a place like Women House where obviously there's a bunch of references
yeah
to feminine objects, but like if you were at your friend's house and you picked up their lingerie by mistake, yeah, you'd be a little embarrassed because I mean that's like something you wear in
right
private.
But that's different though.
But yeah, this is different. This is like an art installation that's focusing on women. Like, you shouldn't be so shocked when you accidentally pick up something.
Yeah,
like that.
You're not shocked about like
the egg boobs on the
yeah
wall,
but,
like,
but the pillow is too much.
They're like, oh my goodness, he like jumps
so
back.
Inappropriate.
Everybody's like, oh my gosh, yeah. So Miriam Shapiro's like, why did I laugh at that?
But in a way, though, I feel like you know, everyone laughed at him for being embarrassed about it.
Yeah,
you know
that's
what I
true
mean? So that's kind of what I thought you meant when you said she.
Oh
laughed.
Yeah, that's
but,
true.
But maybe it was just kind of like a, haha, it's a.
I think it was like almost to be like, don't be embarrassed, like ha ha, like
yeah
laughing along with him, because she said like later on, like, yeah, why did I do that? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Right.
This one's super cool. So this one's called The Nursery. It's a separate room, and this is by Shawnee Woolen Man. And this room includes all oversized stuff, like all oversized nursery furniture and oversized toys. And it's meant to simulate the feeling of being a young child again and stepping
cool
into this room. Yeah, so like, as soon as you step in this room, you feel like you're a small person inside like a normal sized nursery. It's super cool.
Oh, that's really cool.
I know, right? I'd love to walk through it because
mm-hmm
the picture really doesn't do it justice, I feel. I don't know, I just like, there is a movie on this called Woman House where it kind of like goes more in depth into all the rooms.
Cool.
So you kind of get a better sense of like what this room felt like too.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that actually is the last installation of this house that I have to talk about. There were many more installations, but honestly, if I talked about all of them, this would go on way too long,
mm-hmm,
but I picked, like, my favorite ones. And so, just, like, for a little wrap-up, the project garnered a lot of attention and became pretty famous However, a lot of the students eventually began to really resent Chicago and Shapiro throughout the whole process, because some felt as though like they were putting unrealistic expectations on them, and that Chicago and Shapiro had like power trips. And some also thought that Chicago was just projecting her own goals and mindset onto the artist to represent. But I don't know, I did hear a lot of artists like say the opposite of that. And Judy Chicago didn't really pay any mind to this criticism. She said that her students' feelings were simply a result of their own, and this is a quote, "It was simply a result of their own internalized sexism and unconscious manifestations of their own difficulties dealing with female authority figures."
Mm.
So she's saying, like, they have a hard time being told what to do by a female. I don't know how much I buy into that.
Oh, I definitely, yeah, I think there's some merit to that.
Yeah, well, and you have to, like, look at this through the lens of a woman in the 1970s. You know, times were different. So, you know, maybe they did have this internalized sexism that was driving these negative feelings towards the whole process.
Yeah.
But this was, like, really therapeutic experience. Like, it wasn't just, like, create the art piece and move on. Like, it was meant to reshape the girls. So I could see why some of them kind of struggled with their feelings about this whole thing.
Right.
But another thing is, the students were also responsible for giving tours of Women House. Some of them, like, performed all day while tours were coming in and out. So by the time, like, it was time to wrap up this whole thing, a lot of them were just, like, super excited to be done and get back to their own individual projects. But I also think, like, it was really nice that they were there and so involved in the tours, because that meant whenever people walked through, they got to explain, you know, their installation.
Own, in, yeah, what it meant to them.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, it couldn't be misinterpreted, you know. And they also could respond to any criticism that people gave, like, directly. So it really created this interesting conversation between the viewers and the creator of the piece. So Women House was actually the first feminist art project to receive national attention. And the exhibition became a conversation starter, and it sort of introduced the idea of feminism to the general public as being this revolutionary movement, because this was, again, the early 1970s. And because of this work, a lot of debates and criticism were sparked, but it all helped because it all started the conversation.
Yeah.
And 1 year after Women House closed, in an article published by Miss Magazine, they wrote about the exhibit, and I'll just end it on this quote. They said, "Many women artists have organized, are shedding their shackles, proudly untying the apron strings, and in some cases, keeping the apron on, flaunting it, and turning it into art."
Aww, so that's cute.
I thought that was a cute little quote to end it on. So, yeah, wow, definitely
that's
check
really
it out.
Cool. I kind of want to watch the movie now. Have you seen it?
Yeah. Oh. We watched it in college, actually, and that's when I was like, oh my god, this is so cool, because like, me talking about it doesn't do it justice. Like, the videos are so cool, and the videos have performances as well, so you can see, like, the whole works. It's really something else.
Oh, I want to see it.
Yeah, that's definitely so cool. An eerie feeling. Like, this artwork gives me an eerie feeling that I can't really describe. It's like this weird feeling that
it's like you're being confronted with your own, like, struggle.
Yeah.
Or something. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's just kind of, like, uncomfortable to look at in a good way.
It was, like, yeah, it's just, like, kind of interesting to look at. And it makes me think of how uncomfortable it was for people in the 1970s to look at this. Because,
right,
you know, for example, the menstruation bathroom, there's fake bloody used tampons everywhere. I'm sure people had a real big problem with that, and we're just like, this is disgusting, this is not art. But the thing is art goes so much deeper than just a visually pleasing picture that you put on a wall.
Yeah.
It's like, it's very conceptual at the same time. So
yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. So I was really excited to cover a conceptual kind of installation art piece to switch it up. And I know that was really long-winded.
No, it was like the perfect amount of time.
Okay, good. I was like, this is going to be a lot. So I was kind of like getting out of breath, but I was so excited to talk about it that it was really fun. So
yeah, no, we're right on the money here. So
yeah,
I suppose we'll wrap it up.
I suppose that does it. So we will catch you guys on January 4th.
Yes.
With the newest episode after a little break.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you guys have a wonderful holiday season, whatever holiday that you celebrate, or if you don't celebrate holidays, I just hope you have an amazing time, relaxing, enjoying life. Please stay safe.
Yeah.
Right?
If you're gonna see family, make sure you're staying safe.
Get tested. Testing is so fast and easy now. It's like, it's even at Walmart. You can get tested at Walmart. Mm-hmm. So
when I did it, I got tested at CVS even.
Oh,
I just
yeah.
went through the drive-thru and...
So fast.
To me. It was
like,
super fast. So.
No excuse not to get tested at this point.
Right.
So,
yep. If you
totally
have any doubts, get tested. But yeah, so follow us on Instagram, Facebook, email us, do the thing, whatever you want. I don't know. Rate us, review us.
Rate us, review us. We would love you forever if you leave a positive review.
Mm-hmm.
So
that whole spiel. And
yeah.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Happy holidays.